As we move closer to the elections, we take stock of the political parties playing a role in this year's elections. This morning, we continue our series with Asri to ensure our listeners make informed decisions and choices at the polls. And we take a look at the history of Muslim political parties in South Africa. On the line, we have Asri's Muhammad Kaji. Muhammad, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Walaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Mohammed, the Africa Muslim Party was founded in 1994. And this party and the Al-Jamaa contested the 2009 general elections. But both these parties, as well as the Cape Muslim Congress, have not fared very well in the elections. Why are these parties, which set out to represent the Muslim community, not supported by Muslims in their numbers?
But I think in South Africa, we have a tradition where Muslims have largely supported, at the point of democracy, the African National Congress, or the ANC, because of the historical sort of involvement in the United Democratic Front, as well as the South African Indian Congress, and the sort of, you know, alliance between those entities, you know, eventually resulting in 1994. And as you mentioned, the African Muslim Party contesting the election at that point and not winning a seat at all. The second point is that identity-based parties don't necessarily do very well in our elections. And as a Muslim community, we're not a monolithic entity in terms of, let's call it, political ideology. So there's multiple ideologies in our community, where you have those who have very strong sort of social democratic leanings, you have those who have leftist or, you know, black consciousness leanings in terms of their political involvement and activism. And then you have others who have more sort of liberal, you know, economic leanings and so on. So you can't necessarily say that as a Muslim community we have this monolithic identity which draws us as a community to vote for a single Muslim party. And that really comes down to the issue with the Muslim party, that they're generally quite small, they're generally led by a single individual, don't have very strong internal democratic processes within the party, they're not very well funded by individuals or by members and so on. And then their policy positions aren't necessarily welcoming to the broad base of ideological leanings that we have within the community. So in that sense, historically, you know, citizens of the Muslim faith have generally chosen larger parties where they feel that their visions and, you know, goals for the country are met by these big parties.
When we look at, you know, this type of trend that has emerged, and you spoke about the fact that at the advent of democracy, Muslims did see their home in the ANC. And now moving forward, is there maybe a belief that Muslims do not feel the need to have a party representing their interests because they are perhaps well protected under the constitution?
I think definitely, you know, that the Constitution gives us the broad umbrella of rights that Muslims elsewhere in the world are still fighting for. You know, I lived in the States for about 2 years, and in the States, there's still very much a battle for the rights of Muslims in the workplace, for example, in terms of, you know, Jummah or Salah or Hijab, etc. And many of those victories are won already. In South Africa, we take it for granted that, you know, if you want to wear hijab to the workplace, it's fine. There's nothing wrong. Nobody's going to contest it. If you're leaving for Juma between 12 and 2, it's like a well-known, established fact within all workplaces in South Africa that Muslim employees would go for Juma between 12 and 2. And many of these battles are still being fought. Also, the battle around, you know, Muslim identity and the sort of discrimination that Muslims face in terms of Islamophobia, etc., is also still a battle within workplaces, especially in, you know, the States and other countries where immigration is a relatively recent phenomenon, like some European countries. So in South Africa, you know, those broad sort of, let's call them social or identity rights are already very much being won. So now what's left is really the interests of wider society and the interests of sort of hyper-local communities, where it's about, you know, the quality of services that are being experienced within a community, or, you know, the quality of schools or hospitals or clinics, and then the broader trajectory of the country, where the country is heading, what sort of governance the country is facing. So, you know, I think in that sense, you're completely right, Mufti Musaji, that, you know, because of the rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, much of the political discourse is really around broader issues in terms of what's happening in the wider South African context.
Then there's a sentiment that sometimes you tend to pick up amongst people who feel that this constitution has been brought to us via the ANC and via the president at that time, Nelson Mandela, who had promulgated it. And there's a sentiment amongst individuals who feel that because of that, you have to be eternally grateful to the ANC. How do you view that type of a sentiment?
I disagree with that sentiment completely, because The strength of our democracy is only as good as the strength of our civil society. That's my view. And it's critically important that as a community, we see ourselves as part of wider South African society and then continue to ensure that the constitution is held through, or the sort of governing party and those who have been elected into power, regardless of political party, are then held accountable for ensuring that the constitution is implemented, but also, you know, there's this concept of progressive realization of rights within the constitution, and I think that we're nowhere near the vision that the constitution laid out for specific areas such as education and healthcare, employment, land, for example. So there's a huge amount of work that still remains to be done to actually achieve what's been enshrined in the Bill of Rights within the Constitution. So, you know, that sort of sentiment of saying, well, the ANC, and it isn't necessarily so that the ANC got liberation. There were multiple liberation movements that were involved, and there were multiple players, and, you know, the United Democratic Front was made up of tens, if not of hundreds of, you know, organizations who were part of this front that were working in communities across the country. There wasn't a direct link between the ANC and the UDF in the sense that, you know, there was this chain of command. The UDF was a structure on its own that obviously had sympathies towards the ANC and had many ANC leaders that were involved in it, but it wasn't a sort of direct chain of command between the UDF and the ANC within the 80s. So, you know, that view, I think, is part of our history, that the ANC was directly involved in the negotiations for the Constitution, CODESA, and they very much took the lead, with other parties that were involved around the table, and other individuals, not just Nelson Mandela. But the real point to make is that as civil society, it's critically important that we are actively involved in where the country is heading for the future, maintaining that those who are elected into office in the coming election are held accountable. So number one, obviously going to vote for who best represents our ideals and aspirations for the country, but then also maintaining a level of activism between elections to hold those elected accountable.
What are the benefits of a political party specifically aimed at Muslims? You have the example of the African Christian Democratic Party, which sets out to fulfill the needs of Christians, and some would say this particular party does it quite well. So what could be benefits for a Muslim party focusing on Muslim issues?
Let me just use that example, Mufti Musaji. You know, the African Christian Democratic Party is an identity-based party that is aiming to serve the broad Christian community in South Africa. And if we look at the numbers of the Christian community in South Africa, the ACDP doesn't necessarily poll at the levels of the numbers of the Christian identity in South Africa. And similarly for Muslim parties, are also identity-based parties, and traditionally they've managed to secure, you know, one or two seats at municipal level during elections. And I was just pointing this out, like if we look at the Western Cape or even Cape Town, Cape Town's population is roughly 30% Muslim. But the Muslim parties that contest in Cape Town, such as Al-Jamaa and the Cape Muslim Congress, you know, at most secure one to two seats during the municipal elections. And this has been an ongoing trend over multiple years, not just one election. So I think that for Muslim citizens who feel that they can't vote for any of the other parties, then I guess the Muslim parties do provide an option for them to explore. But I suspect that many of them aren't necessarily going to vote for a Muslim party purely because it's Muslim. There's other factors that people consider. Who's the leader of the party? What are the policy solutions, or what are the views that this party would then represent if they manage to secure a seat within parliament? I think that the reason that you have Muslim parties able to contest the elections is obviously because of our proportional representation system, that, you know, votes across the country would then be put into this bucket for the single party. So, you know, in a constituency-based system, it would be much more difficult for identity-based parties to do well. And, you know, something that we don't think about, which is actually also within the bucket of identity-based parties, is the IFP. And over time, the IFP itself had also been declining in terms of its votes, not necessarily just because it's an identity-based party, primarily sort of framed as a Zulu party, but, you know, also because of its leadership in the form of, you know, Chipango Sutuputelezi, who's been the leader for as long as I can remember. So those factors also play a role that, you know, because it's a Muslim-based party, doesn't necessarily mean that they automatically would secure the vote of Muslims, because as I described, there's this broad spectrum of ideological views, but then there's also an exploration of, you know, should this individual who's the leader of the party be elected to parliament, would he or she be representing the views of the Muslim community, because it's framed as a Muslim-based party. So the assumption would be that the views would be very much representative of the broad views of the Muslim community, and that isn't necessarily the case.
With the advent of democracy 25 years ago in South Africa, there has been, in the various political parties, Muslims that have been part of those parties. And as time has gone on, we've seen people talking about or lamenting the fact that we don't have that many Muslims interested in politics or actively taking part. But is that the only way that people can contribute from the ambit of civil society? Is there scope for Muslims to continue to contribute to the political discourse and as issues of governance from the angle of civil society?
I think there's numerous avenues for Muslims to get involved in. And you know, I say this regularly, that if we actually look at the representation of Muslims in wider civil society organizations, such as Equal Education or Corruption Watch or, you know, the Legal Resources Center, etc., you have numerous Muslims who are involved in these civil society organizations in their professional capacities, because these are the organizations that they are working at as their day jobs per se. But there's also a passion there for their contribution to social justice and wider civil society. If you look at the civil service, not necessarily your political tiers or elected political tiers, you also have representation of Muslims or involvement of Muslims across the board. So I think there's numerous avenues. The one is obviously getting involved in the civil service and giving some time into the civil service, be it, you know, SARS or National Treasury or the bureaucracy within governance. That's one. The other is civil society is obviously a professional career aspiration. That's two. And then thirdly would be organizations that welcome volunteerism and involvement of citizens, such as the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation, for example, that's doing excellent work in terms of anti-racism and those sort of things. And additional to that would then be involvement in political parties, becoming members of political parties, becoming actively engaged in the branches of the political parties. And that's really the avenue for individuals who are aspiring for political office to be able to then progress in their political careers. And then fourthly, obviously, is universities. Universities are incredibly important for producing this next generation of civic leaders and university students being actively involved in the MSA, for example, or even the student formations at the universities, such as contesting SRC elections and so on. So there are numerous avenues. And I'll add one additional one, which is the community civic associations. You know, so I think in Malaysia, there's Malaysia Civic Association, if I'm not mistaken. And those formations, in terms of representing the interests of the white community, are very important as mobilization and organizing points to be able to then post-election hold government representatives accountable. And I think this is where the problem in our politics came about within the last 10 years. And I feel that, you know, Jacob Zuma was great for the country because he single-handedly, you know, reactivated civil society in terms of civil society starting to mobilize between themselves and start having discussions around political accountability. But I think it all starts with the individual citizen looking around where he or she is and looking for civic associations or, you know, civil society organizations or political parties and so on, and for them to choose one in which they're willing to give some time. And that's really where the sort of reactivation of activism starts.
A lot that we can reflect on this morning. Mohammed, we appreciate your time on Radio Islam and we look forward to the coming interviews as part of this collaboration between Radio Islam and Asri. Jazakumullah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Jazakumullah khairan.
That was Mohammed Kaji of Asri speaking to us about the history of Muslim political parties in South Africa, looking at some of the pros as well as the cons.